In a free market capitalist system, you're only supposed to benefit to the extent that someone else is benefiting from your actions. But I don't think their intention was to create this massive wealth gap. It was entirely predictable that that would happen, but they convinced themselves that it wouldn't. We still have to deal with the fact that we have an unfair system, that we are going down an unsustainable path that will not end well unless we end it ourselves. And so what to do about it? So
welcome, Paul, to the show. Thank you so much for reaching out to me and expressing willingness to participate, really.
Thank you, yeah.
It really means the world to me, you know? Like, I've only had a handful of people reach out, and it makes such a difference. Like, it's one thing to to be the one reaching out, and it's another to be offered an opportunity to speak. And I actually, I will make a separate episode about your book to my listeners, because I do primarily episodes about books that I read.
And yeah, I noticed that. Yeah.
Since I've read your book, I thought, I'll probably break it down for them. But I kind of feel that it would be beneficial for us to maybe first of all kick it off by you briefly introducing yourself. I know that you've been a capital investor for many years, and then you've, sort of got frustrated with the way the system works, wrote the book, and you have a very active blog, basically teaching people or at least informing people on what's going on. And so if you'd like to introduce yourself briefly, and then maybe I'll kick it off. I have some questions, and I'd like to have a discussion as well. I have some thoughts.
That'd be great. Yeah, so thank you. Well, so I was a professional investor for most of my career, 30 years, I guess, and loved my job. I felt that I was performing an important role in a free market capitalist system. You're only supposed to benefit to the extent that someone else is benefiting from your actions. But increasingly, people are benefiting at the expense of other people rather than a mutual benefit system. We can talk about that after. And as I saw that happening, I became increasingly frustrated with what was going on. Now, the reason I felt I played an important role was because I was taking my clients' capital and allocating it to what I thought were some of the best run businesses around the world, who were going to put that capital to productive use to create more capital. Now, this is the way the system is supposed to work. Companies put capital to productive use. They create more capital. Their profit goes up. They hire more people. They pay them more. More customers buy their products because the customer value proposition is increasing. So all of this increased capital pushes the share price up. And if most companies in the market are doing that, then the stock market goes up. So a rising stock market used to be symptomatic of great things happening in the economy, true wealth being created. And so I felt I had an important role to play. Now, the finance industry, just like government, were very important, but we don't produce any capital of our own. We're the facilitators of capital creation in the real economy, like I like to call it. So, but it is an important role. But then central banks started to short circuit this system, if you will, rather than help establish the conditions for the greatest creation of capital, for the best, the optimal allocation of capital and scarce resources that would drive stock markets higher. Central banks decided, it's a lot easier and quicker instead to drive stock markets higher first and hope that that's going to drag up the economy with it and hope that that will result in more capital being produced. Well, no, theory would tell you that that's not going to happen, and it hasn't. And all it's resulted in is stock markets that are more expensive. They've gone up because valuations went up, not because more capital was created. And it results in wealth disparity, it results in monumental amounts of debt, and it results in misallocation of capital. So you have slowing productivity growth. So anyways, we can go into any of that if you're interested. But when I was witnessing this happening, I became very frustrated. And so you started talking about it with my clients. My clients were financial advisors, financial planners, stockbrokers, stuff like that. And I would always take a very intellectually honest approach to my communication. When I started off in the business, I would always try and impress people with how smart I was. I figured that would be the best way to get their money. It's an awful way to get people's money. And because you're getting it under false pretenses, you know, making people think I was smarter than I really was. And they might not have really understood what it was I was doing, how I was allocating their clients' capital, what to expect from us in different market environments. So after a while, I just got so sick of doing that, that sort of dishonest approach. And so I'm not going to do that anymore. It's going to be blatantly, brutally honest with my clients about what it is I do, what I cannot do, and what to expect from us. When we will do well, when we won't do well, but here's why. And be very careful about the words that I choose to ensure that people really understand what it is we're doing. And it was amazing what happened when I did that. The response was overwhelmingly positive. And we ended up raising a lot of money over the years and made a lot of great relationships. So on my blog, it's a free blog, a lot of my former clients receive this on a weekly basis. And I hear from every now and then, and they like to follow along. So I've built friendships over the years as well as business partners. And as I was talking about what central banks were doing and the harm that they were doing, over the years, every now and then, a client would say, Paul, you should really write a book about this because you're the only one we know who talks about it quite in this way. And I just thought, that's interesting, yeah. But then as time went on, I thought, you know, I do need to write a book about this because not enough people know what's going on. And the path that we're on is not sustainable. It's an unfair path, and it will end badly if we don't end it ourselves. And nobody, I think, will escape harm if it's an out of control explosion. If we don't take responsibility for it and change things. So that's why I felt the need to write the book. And so the book is written. So it's called Capital Offense, Why Some Benefit at Your Expense. And it's because central banks take your capital from you without your permission. We can talk exactly how that happens. And and it's written in very easy to understand terms. They use analogies and stories and step by step, starting with the concept of money. One of the reasons policymakers get away with what they're doing, with good intentions, by the way, is because most people don't understand the difference between money and capital. And so it took me 5 years to write it. Yeah, 5 years. Started in 2019, sent it to the publisher in 2024, and it was published last year. And so now I'm just trying to spread the word and help people understand what's going on, because the only way we can change the system, the system will only change if the people demand it. It will only change from a grassroots, bottom-up type of method rather than a top-down, because no leader can make the necessary but difficult decisions because the people don't believe that they're necessary. And so it's political suicide to do the right thing. So if you have enough people telling you this is what we want and we will vote you into power if you do this for us, then policymakers will finally do the right thing, because they're not bad people. I do believe for the most part all of this is just good intentions gone bad. it's arrogance, it's short-term thinking. But I do believe that they thought things somehow would work out by artificially driving asset prices higher. Sometimes the benefits would somehow the benefits would trickle down to everybody else. Of course they wouldn't. They haven't, and they're not going to. And so now they're starting to look for alternatives, which are really bad, because none of the alternatives fix the system. And yeah, so that's how I got to here.
No, yeah, great. Thank you for that sort of introduction. And as well, you kind of pinpointed what we're going to talk about today. One question, which I might have just forgotten. When did you start your career, and when did you officially finish working as a capital investor?
Yeah, so I started in 1992 in the finance industry. I started late in life. I had a different path than most for various reasons. But I started in the finance industry. I was 30. And then finished in, well, I mean, I'm still involved, obviously. I'm a, you know, I have an investment consulting business. And that finished in, I finished with McKinsey Investments. I'm back in my old office right now, actually. I still have a relationship with McKinsey.
Awesome. No, that's great. Yeah, so, you know, in terms of what you've said, and I agree vehemently, in particular on the point that people are just not aware. And with as many different topics in the world, it seems to me, there are essential things that, on purpose or not on purpose, have been not educated, not told to people, maybe hidden from us. Personally, yeah. I do not think a lack of financial education in the public education sphere is a, you know, something that just happened. I think it's purposefully made into something that is very difficult to understand. There is a lot of, which you actually mention in the book, that there is a lot of, you know, sort of jargon that makes people feel like they don't know what they're talking about. It's very easy to get convoluted with all the economic, you know, understanding. And then when you actually get into the like the grit of it and start to understand what money is, it becomes very, very simple.
Yeah.
This is not to say that it's easy to get there. You got to educate yourself. Yeah. But I think on this, I completely agree. And will in a moment, I'll ask you to maybe briefly just share with me and my audience, what do you think money is versus that capital that you mentioned. But on another front, I just wanted to mention what I sort of gotten out of your book, and I wanted to ask you one thing. So sure. I kind of understood, as you said, that the central argument is that modern monetary policy and financial systems unintentionally create structural inequality. And it's largely because most people misunderstand money and economics, right?
Yeah.
So before we go into what is money and what is capital, I just wanted to ask you, because I'm not so sure that unintentionally is the right statement there. I believe in 1971, Nixon took dollar of the gold standard. In 1913, the Federal Reserve was founded. And before that, there were three other attempts at creating a central bank in the United States, and the Central Bank of England existed long before. So yeah. It is not obvious for me, and obviously this is not an easy topic to talk about with people that are in the system. There is this interesting sentence. Mind you, I'm an auditor at one of the big four as well. So like, I've been also educated in economics while I was reading books that basically told me that what I'm being taught at uni is completely crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, there is this idea that people cannot accept ideas that would put in trouble their way of making money. So they will simply just oppose it by ignoring or by, you know, saying that it's not untrue. And I just wanted to push you to maybe expand on that idea. Why do you think it's unintentionally? Because to me, it seems like it's exactly how they wanted it to be.
Well, so I guess it depends what it is you're talking about they want it to be. So it was intentional that the asset prices are higher. So they intended to drive asset prices higher. Stock markets and housing, and we can talk later about why house prices have no business going up in price because they're not productive assets, and how it's resulted in these housing affordability crises in so many developed economies. So that is true. And of course, the proponents of this and their cheerleaders all benefited enormously. Now, when you are set, it's just human nature, when you are set to benefit enormously from something, you're going to justify not only with other people why it's a good idea, but also in your own mind why it's a good idea and how other people are not going to be harmed. And don't worry, you're going to benefit too. You'll see. And so when they drive asset prices higher, it's just, I believe, maybe good intentions. I mean, selfish intentions for sure.
Now, would you say maybe it's like putting a Band-Aid on a, you know, on a cut-off leg kind of thing? It seems to me that, as you said earlier, it's like short-term solution, kind of like, as they say, kicking the can down the road.
Well, yeah, but it's not even really a solution for the economy. It's just a solution for the stock market. So it's a solution for a bear market, is to drive those asset prices higher because they believe in what's called the wealth effect. Now, the wealth effect, as you know, is when stock markets are soaring. So first we'll talk about stocks. Stock markets are going up. People feel wealthier because they see their portfolios going up. And so they might borrow money on that inflated stock wealth and go spend that borrowed money. And then that's good for GDP. But all GDP is final spending, right? 2/3 of which is consumption. And so many economists and politicians mistakenly believe that consumption is the fount of all economic prosperity. That consumption is what's needed to grow an economy. No, consumption is the reward for growing the economy. You grow the economy through saving and investment. That then gives you the wherewithal to go consume. But they think consumption is the most important thing in an economy rather than the outcome or the reward. And so they drive asset prices higher so people feel wealthier. So they go and spend and consume more. And they think that's good for the economy. They've convinced themselves, because they also benefit from this, that it's good for the economy. So that's why I do believe that they might have, they knew for sure that the rich would benefit from this, but I do believe they thought that others would benefit from it as well because of the whole consumption thing. And but when you distort asset prices, when you distort the price discovery mechanism of capital markets, you get misallocated capital. Capital that's not allocated optimally, and so you get declining productivity growth. You get fewer people working than there otherwise would have been. They're not making as much as they would have otherwise. And with QE and increasing money supply, the cost of living also goes up, and so people are being robbed of the diminished amount of wealth that they are producing. And so then you get to this point where those who proposed this and implemented this policy naturally don't want to be blamed for all the growing wealth disparity, for debt levels that are going through the roof. And so then they'll come out with stuff like, well, debt doesn't matter, deficits don't matter, all this kind of nonsense. But when people tell them, when you look at the surveys and people tell you know, the or say that their life is difficult and they're not happy, then these idiot policymakers come out and tell these people they don't know what they're talking about. And you see these op-eds every now and then in the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal. It might be a former central banker or something like that, who say, never mind about all those surveys. People are happier, people are wealthier, better off than they've ever been. They can't stand the fact that people are unhappy because of their actions. And so I'm not saying they're nice people. I'm not saying they're people who I respect. But I don't think their intention was to create this massive wealth gap. It was entirely predictable that that would happen, but they convinced themselves that it wouldn't.
Yeah, no, I on that point, then we agree. You know, it rings in my head the sort of idea that the point of a system is what it does. If someone tells you they want to lose weight and year on year they become fatter, they probably don't want to lose weight. You know, mm-hmm. Consciously they might be telling you something, but the system that they follow will make them go up in size.
Because it's all about consumption, right?
So it's essentially like the potentially, let's agree, I'm not going to push on that because obviously I don't know people. I've just been reading and educating myself on the subject, and it seems to me that as they say, sometimes the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and let's give them the benefit of the doubt. It's just a side effect of the system that they've been following, and obviously we see that it doesn't, you know, we see the results, right?
And that's what I have done. I've given them the benefit of the doubt, and I could be wrong, you know, and you're not the first to push back on that, by the way.
No. Yeah. Well, of course, it's just, I shared it with my wife kind of like when we were talking about the podcast as I was preparing, I said that this one word that I've written down unintentionally, I've been both on the side of like financial education, emotional education, the food we eat, the way we live, even the kind of, you know, space that we live in. It seems to me that there is a lot of knowledge that is omitted. I'm not saying it's intentional. I don't have a proof of that. I just noticed that I've never been educated on these things until I wanted to learn myself. And unfortunately, as you said, and this is the whole of my podcast as well, I don't think people read books these days enough, and I don't think people educate themselves enough. So now let's get into the whole inflation and you know, QE and all that part, because I actually had an argument with my father not so long ago. Obviously he's, you know, he's not that interested in learning the difference between Keynesian economics and Mises economics. And he actually argued with me because he said that he doesn't mind inflation as long as it's small, because obviously, as Keynesian economics says, it actually drives that consumption, hence drives the, you know, the growth of the GDP that they measure everything with. So please, can you make a case for the benefit of my father and my listeners? Why should we, even if we are privileged enough to have enough money not to feel it instantaneously, why should we care about inflation? And why do you think it's wrong?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, it's theft. And you do not need inflation for an economy to grow. Now, in the, you know, central bankers, they always warn about the horrors of deflation. Now, there's good deflation and there's bad deflation. So if you have deflation as a result of a contracting money supply, then that is not good, right? And then you have prices of everything falling. Well, not everything. Debt doesn't fall. Right, it's contractual in nature. So your wages are going down, but your debt still stays up here. Now you can't pay it back. And then it causes a depression, all kind of stuff. But good deflation results in either a flat money supply or a very slowly growing money supply and a boom in the production of stuff. So if you've got money growing like this, but the amount of stuff that is growing even faster, then you have more stuff per unit of money. And so the prices necessarily of all that stuff has to come down. And that's exactly what happened in America in the last 30 years of the 1800s. Money supply was just over 4% growth, I think. I mean, I think it's still too high, but just over 4%. But the amount of stuff being produced was even higher than that. So you had 30 years of deflation. And so even if you had a flat wage, then in real terms, you were getting wealthier every year because your flat wages were buying more stuff every year. That's the way a free market capitalist system is supposed to work. The result is supposed to be good deflation, assuming you have freedom of competition. So companies will reinvest in their business. They're doing something, they reinvest in new technologies, innovation, figure out more efficient ways of doing the same thing or better ways of doing new things, such that the cost of producing things steadily goes down. Profit margin expands. Others see that they enter that industry to compete away that excess profitability, and they do so by offering the same good at a lower price. Good deflation. Who wins? The consumer. The consumer is supposed to be the ultimate beneficiary of all this. And but that doesn't happen because central banks increase the money supply faster than the amount of stuff being produced in the economy. Now, central banks will tell you that deflation is a horrible thing because if you see deflation, then you will put off your consumption. And so the example I use in my book is if there is 2% deflation. So never mind, you know, so even 0% for central banks, they think that's terrible. So I use the example of 2% declining prices. So central banks will tell you that nobody will go out and spend their money because they're all going to wait for cheaper prices next year. It's complete nonsense. So the example I use is a TV, a luxury. You've already got a TV. You're thinking, I might buy another one for the basement. So you're going to have two TVs. So a TV costs $300, but there's 2% deflation. So the central banker will think you're not going to buy that TV because you're going to wait for a year because the price is going to be lower. So are you going to buy it today for $300, or are you going to wait 12 months and save $6 and buy it for $294? You're not going to wait 12 months to save $6. That is not going to change. And this is a luxury, by the way, right? This is not even an essential. Now, if there is falling prices for assets, that's a completely different issue, right? This is not driven by the whole consumption thing. If you've got house prices falling because they've driven up to stupid levels by central bank policy, zero interest rates are buying trillions of dollars in mortgage-backed securities. They're falling because they got stupidly expensive. That is a really good thing to have. That's really good deflation. Asset deflation from bubble levels, that's very good. But we're talking about consumption goods. And so, yeah, and so money, people, and that's another thing, you know, central banks think people need to be encouraged to consume. If there's one thing that the average person does not need to be encouraged to do is to spend their money. If anything, they need encouragement to do the exact opposite. People need to be taught to delay gratification, to save their money and invest it such that you can consume that much more in the future. So as you know, you probably know, the term for that is time preference. So a society with a high time preference, they want to consume everything today and they won't save anything. Society with a low time preference are more willing to delay gratification, save some of their money so they can, you know, consume more in the future. And in driving housing prices higher, central banks, I believe, served to increase the time preference of society. So first of all, it's a redistribution of wealth, which is completely unfair. We can talk in a bit about exactly how that happens. But it also encouraged more people to save and invest less because they figured, well, I don't have to save as much as I would have done otherwise because I can just rely on the inflated value of my home for my retirement. So people saved less than they otherwise would have. So there was less investment going on in the economy than there otherwise would have. And so there's less stuff being produced than there otherwise would have been, which also reduces in lower prices or results in lower prices. So, so that's my comment.
No, yeah, it's great that you laid that out. And I'm going to follow with this observation. Putting my tinfoil hat on, it seems to me that people in a system that people of high time preference, people that are pushed to spend whatever they earn, you know, in extreme cases such as in Venezuela, where, you know, you have hyperinflation or many other countries, really, to the point that by the end of the day, the wage you've earned is, you know, half of that value. And so you rush just to maybe buy a batch of potatoes to even just get you through the night. The people in a state of poverty, let's say it bluntly, or at least a state of fear for their existence for tomorrow, are much easier and much weaker and much easier to control. And if you consider the this weirdly malicious, from my perspective, alliance between central banks and, you know, say the government, corporations, whatever you want to call them, it depends on the country, of course. This driving of people to never save, always spend, makes it easier for many, you know, activities and decisions to be delegated to those that can wait. And and this is the driving, you know, K-shaped economy that you've alluded to, where it almost seems like if you don't pay attention and if you don't get yourself on the right side of that equation, over time you become more and more a slave, and over time someone else is becoming more and more a master. And you know, this is what you said about the redistribution, right? It's yet again, you know, I wholeheartedly I agree with the with the mission of yours, really, that we should highlight this to people simply for their own benefit. This is not to fight the system, or this is not to do whatever, like, you know, we don't have to be revolutionaries. As you said, it's a grassroots idea. If you take care of yourself, you will be able to take care of your family. If you take care of your family and yourself, you can take care of your community. If you can take care of your community, you can take care of your country. Otherwise, if you cannot take care of yourself, no wonder that you will not take care of the planet, the nation, and your neighbor. It's like a, you know, in Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, incredible book. I hope you've read it. If not, please. Yeah. It's so blatantly obvious that one is a pro-life choice. If you make yourself better, by the extension, you will make the world a better place. And the opposite of that is you will just see the world burn, because people that don't save for the future will have to deal with that future consequences, and that's the delayed gratification there. So certainly, you know, it's I'm very passionate about this, and could you then maybe elaborate a little bit on the redistribution as you wanted to mention? Maybe let's briefly come back as well, if you could, to why do you think houses, for example, are not assets? This is a big thing that, you know, people, I often hear when I try to introduce people to, you know, either buying some gold or silver or Bitcoin, they're like, oh, no, man, I'm saving for my first house because then I'm going to rent it out. And, you know, why does that not actually work, first of all, nowadays than before, and why it's actually inherently broken unless you're not living in the house? Unless you're living outside of your house as you have it.
Okay. So first of all, just comment on what you were saying. Yeah, absolutely right. Like, if you're not self-sufficient, can't take care of yourself, then you look to take capital from other people, right? And that's what's been happening. And my blog, every week I sign off with be free and do no harm. And so it's not for me to prescribe to others what they should do, but I can tell people those two things, to be free and make sure you do no harm, because nobody has any right to do harm to other people, either emotionally, physically, or financially. And if you have everybody going around focusing on being free, i.e. do what they love to do, don't worry about what society or policymakers tell you you should and should not do. No, you do what you want to do as long as it doesn't do any harm to anybody else. It's almost impossible not to have a beneficial impact on society. Can you imagine if you had billions of people all doing that? The world would be a much better place, in my opinion. Now, in terms of houses, it's not that I don't think that they're an asset. I just don't think they're a productive asset. So they're a consumptive asset. So the example I use when talking about this is that our house, we live in a suburb of Toronto. We bought it in 2001. It's worth four times. Well, it's not worth four times. The price is four times what we paid for it. But our house is not a productive asset. It's not producing four times as much stuff as it was 25 years ago. It hasn't quadrupled in size. It's the same economic good. It's the same piece of capital that a younger generation or younger couple or a newcomer to our country have to pay us four times what we paid for it.
And so there are probably some holes and some stuff as well that actually made it depreciate in price.
Well, yes, it's a depreciated asset. Now you have to, you've got your own capex that you put into your home, or you should be, to try and keep up with all that deterioration. But no, but you're absolutely right. And so, in a free market capitalist system, like I said earlier, you're only supposed to benefit to the extent someone else is benefiting from your actions. So you make a bike, you just created capital. I make a suit, I just created capital. So in the economy, there was no bike and no suit. Now there's a bike, now there's a suit, and we exchange that with each other. I've got your bike, you've got my suit. And importantly, nobody was worse off because of that all occurring. You and I are both better off because of our productive efforts, and then we exchange the capital with each other. Now, we do it through the medium of exchange called money, which we'll get into in a second. So we're both better off. It's a mutual benefit system. But when we make four times on our home, who else out there is also four times better off? Well, nobody. But it's worse than that, because somebody is four times worse off because they're paying four times what we paid for the same economic good. So all it is you're looking down on society. There's no creation of capital. There's still only one house, same size. There's just a redistribution of capital from the younger couple's bank account into our bank account, a redistribution of wealth. And so you have millions of people, young people, who are priced out of the housing market. Average age of the first-time home buyer in America right now is 40 years old. It used to be 31. So people putting off, and even indeed people giving up on the idea of being able to buy a home and start a family. This is criminal. And so people are pissed. And so this is the something for nothing myth that policymakers have helped propagate, have convinced people that there's such a thing as a free lunch, that deficits and debts don't matter. And it doesn't matter if we drive interest rates to zero to drive asset prices higher. There's no cost to that. There's a huge cost in terms of lower productivity, growth, and all this kind of stuff. And so the next generation, in large part, is helping to fund the retirement of people like me, baby boomers. I'm 64. So the enormous amount of mortgage debt that younger couples have to take on to buy our inflated house prices or pay for our inflated houses is helping to fund the retirement of people like me. And so we're then able to take out of the system more than we put in. And that is completely unfair. That's not the way the system is supposed to work. Now, people my age, we haven't done anything wrong. We haven't broken any rules or laws or, and indeed, a lot of people, I would argue most, who've benefited from this system don't realize that it's coming at somebody else's expense. They believe, well, that, look, house prices just go up. I was lucky.
Yeah.
Or that's just the way it is. And then the younger generation, they'll buy a house and they'll make, well, no, the math doesn't work anymore. And so I've been talking about this for a long time. And you can imagine I've pissed off a lot of people like my age because they don't like hearing it. They like believing that they knew something about real estate or they timed it well or good for you. You know, it's like the, what's the definition of a financial genius? A rising stock market, right? Everybody puts it down to their own ability and whatnot. And if it crashes, then it's a stupid market. And
before we go into money, I just wanted to comment on this as well. It seems like it's actually not only is it that the new generations will have to bear the burden of this, and personally I do believe that 1971 is the date that started this, simply because from then on money in the Western world and majorly in the world really suddenly became essentially free to produce, and this is, I think, the what we're experiencing right now is just the it's catching up on us, because also enough of generations passed and started, you know, living. And what I wanted to say is not only is it that the younger generations will have to bear the burden of this debt, but also because of this dynamic there are less people to bear the load. You said you're a baby boomer. Why? Because there was a boom of babies after the war, and in the system that they've created, essentially it assumes that in the future there will be more people taking the load. So at least let's assume that this scheme will work on that premise. Mm-hmm. Well, they failed to take into account that as prices will go up and as people can not afford to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 kids, you will actually face the music where you have a collapsing societies all around, where there is less people to even keep the same amount of people going forward. I don't think there's more, I don't know of any country in Europe that has enough, you know, babies per capita to keep the same level of, which is also an excuse for all that migration that is happening, as if that was the, you know, the solution. So it's just almost like all those, you know, all those models that you mentioned. A model is great until, as Mike Tyson said, the planning is great until you get punched in the face. The market is inherently irrational, and if you play to the to people the music of fear and not being able to meet the future, they will hesitate to bring kids into the future. And then you have situations such as today, where I'm sorry to say that majority of my friends are hesitant to even have one kid, simply because they think that it's not, you know, oh, the world is going to be worse, or I cannot afford it. I don't think it's the right time. I will wait until I have XYZ. So yeah, I just wanted to sort of vent there that it's bigger problem than
that. Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. And you know, I listened to a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and this one economist was talking about the global fertility rate that has fallen below replacement value. And he said that the main reason this has happened is because house prices around the world have soared. And so people like your friends, they just keep putting it off and delaying it. And I also mentioned in my book back in 1983, when François Mitterrand, president of France, he reduced the retirement age from 65 to 60. You know, he looks like a benevolent economic political genius. You know, look, he lowered the retirement age. We're all retiring 5 years earlier. Nothing bad happened to the economy. Of course not. The consequences are 20, 25 years in the future when he's long gone and doesn't have to face the consequences of those short-term, and I would argue very selfish actions, very selfish decisions. Even if he believed that it would somehow work out, they delude themselves into believing it'll work out because they'd rather look like a hero today. And there should be no system that requires a growing population. Growing population is fine, like within reason, because then you have more people contributing to the economy, more new ideas, the more possibility of a new Mozart or a new Einstein or whatever. All these things are good, you know, but you should not, that should not be your basis to make the economy grow. You do not need a growing population to grow an economy. And I use a sort of island economy example in my book. And what you need a growing economy for, or a growing population, is to allow the older people to take out more than they put in. And so we need to stop this. Generations need to live within their means. And it's not that hard. But it's hard when you've told them that they can, and now you have to change it. And they don't want to hear it.
Yeah. This takes us swiftly into the topic of short-term sort of solutions, which, you know, if you think about it, you just sparked a thought in my mind that, you know, you're in Canada, you have a very similar system that United States and the majority of the democratic world has it, that we have a tenure of 4 years roughly of the government or the president or whoever is running the country before they get elected again, and there is this mm-hmm. contest of popularity and a contest of whoever can raise more money to fund their, you know, basically a show. Mm-hmm. And 4 years in terms of any investment is please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that it's a very short term. Mm-hmm. Even learning, as we can see from education that is offered in the public school, it takes quite a while, sometimes 6 years, sometimes 3 years, sometimes whatever, however many more. And in this system where to be elected, you have to show that you've done good or promise that you will and then deliver, you will obviously focus most easily at short-term solutions that will give you that electorate. Such as you mm-hmm. said, you know, you lower the age of retirement, and suddenly, you know, however many millions of people are like, yeah, I'm going to vote for that guy. I don't want to work anymore. And yeah. In tune with this rising, you know, problem essentially of debt that is outpacing the reality, you have a group, you know, a fraction of people, let's say, that benefit from making sure that short-term solutions are in place while they are in tenure, and they don't really worry about the future of themselves because obviously they're quite well off, as we can see from many businesses that, you know, people in power make in the meantime, because they are in the limelight. And, you know, obviously, even as we are talking right now, the moment we are talking on stage and 300 million of people are watching, we're benefiting from that. Even if we just had a conversation and then afterwards someone shows up and signs a new contract for your book, or, you know, invites me to whatever, to change my hair for free. So, you know, this is just something that your exploration sparked in my mind, that it's obvious that those guys from the top will not want to change the system because they benefit from it. And even if they wanted, by the time they get there, they realize that it's just going to be a political suicide, as you said.
Yeah.
And hence they sort of, you know, leave it be. And every now and then you have someone screaming about it until they get there. And then suddenly, you know, it's like, oh, he wrote a book a while back, but suddenly, you know, he's not mentioning it. So that's just a little rant there. Please explore for us then, what is money? Because we've talked about capital quite a bit, both productive and not. What is money for you?
Yeah, so money is, what's called the medium of exchange. So, you know, earlier I gave the example of you make a bike, create capital, I make a suit, I create capital, we exchange with each other. That's called direct exchange or barter. But you can't have a large economy with barter because you get all these different prices for all these different goods. It becomes impossible. You know, how many kitchen chairs does it cost to take a flight to Florida and all this kind of stuff? And so instead of exchanging the capital directly, we exchange it indirectly through money, the medium of exchange. So that's all really money is there to do, is to exchange all the capital that's being produced in the world. Now, you can have an economy with capital and no money, albeit a small one, but you can't have an economy with money and no capital. Right now, money also serves, it's got a few different functions, but the main one is medium of exchange, but it also serves as a temporary store of value. So let's say you make 10 bikes and you sell them for $1,000 each, and you've got $10,000 now in your bank account. So what that $10,000 effectively represents is the 10 bikes of capital that you created. So when you go and spend that money, you go and buy something with your $10,000. What gave you the wherewithal to go and purchase was the fact that you created capital. You created 10 bikes. Now you've got purchasing power, which you temporarily store up in your $10,000. So you got 10,000 bucks in the bank, you're storing your 10 bikes of capital. Now, before you get a chance to spend that $10,000, the central bank doubles the money supply. Now, when the central bank creates money, it does so out of thin air. It doesn't first create capital to get that money. It just creates new money. It's got no capital stored up in it. But it obtains capital as soon as it comes into the economy by extracting capital from the rest of the money already in existence. So as soon as that newly printed money or newly created money enters the economy, it takes five of your bikes from your $10,000 and puts it into the new money. So now on your bank statement, it still says you've got 10,000 bucks in your bank account, but your $10,000 is only storing five bikes instead of 10 bikes. And so now your $10,000 will only buy half of what it would have done before the central bank doubled the money supply. And so that's inflation, of course. So you, if you're going to go on a nice vacation that was going to cost 10,000 bucks, once they double the money supply, now that vacation costs $20,000. You don't have enough capital now to be able to afford to go on that vacation. And that's why my book is called Capital Offense, because central banks extract capital from your money savings or from your wages, the purchasing power of your wages, every time they increase the money supply. And it's a hidden tax, as some would call it.
Wonderful, yeah. And no no objection there whatsoever. And I really like how you brought it back to inflation as well. So we agree. Now... We've been going on for somewhat of almost an hour. I just wanted to confirm with you, how do you have any time restraints over like hour and a half? Is hour and a half okay?
Hour and a half is good.
Yeah. Great, amazing. Because I kind of would like to bring it home and not rush. So in terms of what can we do about it, I wanted to ask you then about your opinion on basically on assets, sound money, kind of what is your pitch to my listeners? Let's assume that they are, such as myself, you know, in their let's say, early 20s, and what should they do about it? Because it's all well and good, you know, educating yourself, and I will link below a bunch of different episodes and books that, as well as your book to and your blog to, for them to explore. And as I said, like I'll do a separate episode about your book. But like, what right now? And I wouldn't be myself if I didn't ask, what is your opinion on Bitcoin as well? What can we do about it now? An everyday listener of this, what should they start with to make their make themselves free of that system, right? Or at least free enough not to care that that's occurring on the daily basis.
Well, you cannot be free enough to not care what's going on. I'll explain that in a second. So, as you mentioned, first step is education. You know, there's a line that's an old line, that the people always get the government that they deserve. But that's only true if the people actually understand what's going on and then can demand the right policy actions from their leaders. So we're not doing that. And so our leaders are not doing the right thing. So that's the first thing, like we said earlier, the grassroots from the ground up. So that's step one. Now, in the meantime, to your point, we still have to deal with reality. We still have to deal with the fact that we have an unfair system, that we are going down an unsustainable path that will not end well unless we end it ourselves. And so what to do about it? So I'm not allowed to offer financial advice because I'm not licensed to do so, but I can just tell people what I do. So I invest, so I used to manage mutual funds. I think they're called unit trusts in the UK. And so my team, or my former team, they still are at it on a daily basis, and they're investing in some of the highest quality companies around the world that have long-term sustainable competitive advantages, great corporate culture, strong balance sheets, valuations are reasonable. That's great. So, you know, I've got a lot of money invested in those funds that invest in those companies. Let's say there's 40 companies or something like that. Different industries, some diversified in very high quality businesses. Now, there's no guarantee, and we can talk about that after, but that feels good. Then I've got some gold, and then very recently I became a holder of Bitcoin. And now these are hedges rather than investments. So the reason they're a hedge, so if we manage to fix our system by investment in these high quality companies over the long term, I think we'll do extremely well. And if we fix the system, i.e. go back to a sound currency or hard currency, hard money, then there'll be less need for Bitcoin and gold, and the prices of those will fall. But my high quality businesses will be churning out capital like crazy and growing the wealth of the world, and their share price will reflect that. And so I'm going to be okay. If we don't fix the system, if instead policymakers keep sticking their head in the sand, and by extension, everybody else's, and the only way out of it will be, in my opinion, financial repression. So they will print money, they will do yield curve control, so they will cap long-term interest rates by buying enough, as many long-term bonds as they need to keep the yield low, which causes crazy inflation, like wealth extraction from the rest of society. So then the stocks and my high quality businesses will go up, but in real terms, they'll be going down. But if that's happening, the price of gold, the gold and the Bitcoin in my portfolio should do extremely well. in real terms. And so that will offset that. So that's my plan, you know, and I've got some real estate as well. Central banks can't print houses, so that's good. But, you know, house prices are very expensive right now. So I would expect if the system gets fixed, the prices of those houses will go down.
So, okay, before I sort of dive deeper into this view and maybe offer some of my perspective, I just wanted to ask you, what do you imagine as a fixed system, as you said, and, quote, coming back to sound money? How, let's imagine the, you know, the ideal scenario. What do you envision as such?
Yeah. Okay. Just before I explain my vision, I should comment on something I said earlier that, you know, you won't be able to avoid the risk. And so let's say I'm successful with my hedging strategy that central banks resort to financial repression. My Bitcoin and my gold prices go through the roof. And I think, you know, I did okay and I'm protected. I believe the government is going to come and take your wealth from you. So even if you are successful, you can kiss most of it goodbye. There'll be some massive wealth tax or whatever, because they just will not abide you outsmarting the system, where they will look at you and they will say, hey, look at this guy. You know, he's not paying his fair share. Like, he's got way more wealth than you. I don't have a lot, don't get me wrong, but.
Once everyone's poor, those that are not as poor will be considered wealthy, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. So, and so there's, I don't think there's any way of escaping it unless you are part of the establishment and they'll sort of take care of themselves and it'll, you know, worst case scenario, it ends up like that movie, The Hunger Games, you know, where it's a small city and they're all, anyways. So, now I forgot what your question was.
No. Yeah. So that you sort of, you went into the risk, no risk thing, but I wanted to ask you, what would be coming back to the sound money standard, you know?
Yeah. So in my book, I've got 10 steps. It just happened to be 10. I wish I hadn't done 10, but because I don't like it when it's a nice round number. It's like, it's like you reverse engineered it. Okay, I need 10 steps. Let me see if I can come up with 10. No, it just happened to be 10. So, and none of this can happen without people demanding it. But once people demand it, step one, stop growing the money supply at such a rapid rate. There is nothing, I mean, I would love a gold standard. You know, it's slightly inelastic, you know, it does respond to gold supply, will respond to higher prices or higher demand for money, but not significantly. On the other hand, David Ricardo, I think it was, British classical economist, I think he said that the ideal amount of money in an economy is whatever it is at this precise moment. Just never change it, higher or lower. And so I think a stable money supply would be best, but I could live with a slowly growing money supply. And so there's nothing wrong with a fiat money system per se. What's wrong with it is how easily it's manipulated by those who control it. So if you had strict, firm rules that prevented policymakers from increasing the money supply so quickly, then a fiat currency system would probably be the best one because it's the cheapest. And but The problem is you would have these rules in place. They were not allowed to increase the money supply. The first sign of trouble, they would say, well, we got to break the rules. This is no time for moral to be concerned about moral hazard. That's what they always said during a great financial crisis. Complete garbage. That's exactly when you need to be most concerned about moral hazard. Anyway, so stop growing the money supply so quickly is step one. Step two would be stop distorting interest rates lower, right? They don't distort them higher than a natural rate. They only distort them lower. Now, maybe a little bit of explanation. So in economics, there's such a thing as the called the natural rate of interest. Now, this is very different from the neutral rate of interest. The natural rate is that which is determined by millions of market players with capital and those who need capital. And they get together and they determine what rate of interest based on your risk profile is appropriate. And you put it all together and you get, let's say it's 6%. This is the rate of interest by definition, because if all people with their own capital, own skin in the game have determined, have decided is appropriate on average, it results in the most efficient allocation of capital, the most productive economy, the natural rate of interest, market players, because people are smart when it comes to their own capital and those borrowing it when they have to pay it back. So instead, policymakers focus on what's called the neutral rate of interest. Now, for decades, policymakers have been encouraging debt-fueled consumption because they think consumption, like we said earlier, is what's responsible for all economic prosperity. Complete garbage. So they encourage people to take on debt to consume even more. And so sure enough, they see GDP growing because it adds up all the final expenditures. But then people can't service any more debt, so that spending starts to flatline. GDP is not growing as quickly. And so central banks say, we have to lower the interest rate in order to get people to borrow more so they can spend more. So the neutral rate is that which keeps the economy growing without causing inflation. So they lower the interest rate, people borrow more money, they start spending, and just like the policymakers said would happen, GDP starts to pick up final spending. But guess what? They're tapped out in the debt. They can't take on any more debt because they can't service any more debt. Spending flatlines, so they have to lower interest rates again. And these policymakers are all mystified as to why the neutral rate of interest has been grinding lower and lower and lower for decades. It's because people can't service any more debt, and that debt is not productive. It doesn't give them the wherewithal to pay the debt back. And it's worse, because the lower they take the neutral rate, the further it gets away from this natural rate, which is the one that's best for the economy. So the economy is functioning less and less efficiently or optimally the further it gets away from the natural rate. And so then, of course, people start looking for how ways I can obtain capital from somebody else rather than create it myself. And so that would be the second thing. Stop distorting interest rates lower. I'll give one more thing and then I'll give it back to you. So the third thing would be that central banks have to make it absolutely clear to Wall Street that they are no longer going to be bailed out. That if they make stupid decisions or their leveraged speculative bets go bad, they're not going to be able to hold the world hostage and demand a bailout from the Federal Reserve by them printing trillions of dollars and buying every asset that's not nailed down. And I mean, you see this basis trade in America on 10-year treasuries. The thing is like, I don't know, $1.7 trillion or something like that. Because they all know, all these hedge funds, they know central bank, Federal Reserve stands ready to bail them all out if it goes the other way. And so just these three actions alone, I mean, there's other stuff, So stop increasing the money supply, stop distorting interest rates, stop bailing out Wall Street. Those things would have such a beneficial impact on the economy. Now, initially, it would be very painful. And when they, if they did that, you would see the finance industry shrink significantly as a percentage of the economy. Now, I was in the finance industry, as I said earlier, I thought I was playing a very important role, but we don't create capital ourselves. We facilitate the creation of capital. And it, a lot of the best and brightest out of university, instead of going into engineering or into medicine, they went into finance because that's where you can make the most money in the shortest amount of time. Because you're making money from each other, hedge funds making money from other hedge funds rather than creating capital. And so without the bailout, without printing trillions of dollars to drive asset prices higher, there would be less opportunities to make significant amounts of money in the finance industry. And so it would shrink. And so the real economy would have fewer facilitators on their back, you know, as they're trying to grow. And one last step I would say is the recommendation is to shrink the size of government. Hmm. I'm not anti-government. Government's very important in a limited role. And again, a government does not produce any capital. It's a facilitator of the creation of capital in the private sector. So any capital the government spends, because it doesn't create any of its own, it first has to obtain from the private sector, and it does so in one of three ways: taxation, borrowing, or printing money, extracting the bikes from your capital every time they do so. And so government needs to shrink as a percentage of the economy. So can you imagine if you had that slowly growing money supply or flat, interest rates not distorted at the natural level, no more bailout for Wall Street, that results in a smaller, important finance industry, and then a smaller and important government. The prospects would be enormous for the economy, and the wealth that is being created would be more fairly distributed because it would be based on your productive efforts. And then we can impose our own ideology on top of that. Like, how much should we be giving to those who, for whatever reason, can't earn it? Yes, let's help them. Like you said, help yourself first, help others. But people now, they don't help themselves first, help others. They just take it from other people over there and give it to people over here. The forgotten man.
Yes, it's literally like, we're going down the path, it seems, of what Ayn Rand writes about in the story. Now, I'm mindful of our time, so I just wanted to make some comment, and I'll make sure to expand on your 10 points in my episode for the benefit of our listeners who might become readers and not necessarily. It depends on their time preference. Yeah. I just wanted to maybe be devil's advocate here. I doubt... Lynn Alden has this saying, nothing stops the strain, right? We will be printing simply because that's the only way out, other than that painful way out, which you alluded to. But no one is in the positions of power, unless people vote them in, no one is actually incentivized to change that. And you also really rightfully said that the government expands as to fill the needs of more government, Oscar Wilde said. And from my perspective, I agree with Nietzsche as well, that everything the state has taken is stolen. So inherently, it's almost like they are carrying the private sector, the productive, are carrying on their backs the unproductive, while being sapped of energy more and more. And here we are, sort of trying to fix the system while riding the same wave. And my personal sort of approach to this, the hedge that you mentioned, is especially with my time preference and with my skepticism about actually people in power wanting to change this, is I'm fully hedging. So don't get me wrong, you know, I'm a productive individual, so hopefully I'll be producing in the meantime. But it seems to me that separating money from the state, as great as that would sound, is probably not going to happen. And mm-hmm. therefore, the most likely bet that I'm making is that gold, silver, whatever they cannot, you know, outprint Bitcoin, is the bet I'm willing to bet upon, at least in the short term, meaning 10, 20 years. Let's say, you know, hopefully, I really pray that the world changes its direction, simply because everyone would benefit, even those in power. While initially everyone would feel like there is a bit of pain, it's like at a workout, right? As you start, it's a bit painful, it's uncomfortable, but as you grow, you see the results and you will benefit in the long term. Many people simply are not willing to go through that challenging part. They already mm-hmm. want to see the results, hence, you know, yeah. buy now, pay later, which I think is one of the biggest scams of our time. Mm-hmm. Giving students, I was given a card, I don't know about yourself, but I was given a credit card at university open days from one of the companies with, like, you know, preloaded balance and encouraging people to sign up. As you've never had any education about finance, and here I am, you know, I'm 18, here is a card, go spend it, boy. Like,
yeah, okay.
I've not used it at the time. Now I use a credit card and I understand how it works, but yeah. many people simply don't understand and then they get hurt, and, you know, especially young people unknowingly. Now, this was a bit of a rant. I'm kind of skeptical about the system fixing itself. And I feel we agree that, as you said, unless people demand the change will not occur. Unless, I don't know, maybe we have this one in a century situation that we have some guy that actually powers through all these corridors of people set to not make the change and makes the change. I don't know, you know, maybe there's a messiah coming, who knows? but yeah. if there isn't, maybe just as some final thoughts, you shared with us generously what you do, and you explained as well why people should care and to educate themselves. Whatever you'd like to share as well as final thoughts, maybe for the next 10 minutes we can sort of rant. I looked at my notes earlier, and you know, we've talked about what should people do today. We've talked about the education and why it is or it isn't the way that they teach us. We've talked about growth versus consumption. And so before you make your final sort of statements and stuff, could you suggest as well any sources of education apart from your book that people should explore?
So I would start with Henry Hazlitt and his Economics in One Lesson. Beautifully written and short, you know. And he was a genius. He was more of a journalist, but just a genius. And pretty much anything that he's written, Thinking as a Science is another great book by him, and it's just more about life. You know, I do follow the Austrian School of Economics. I mean, that opened my eyes to a lot of things. I never studied economics really in school, and it was during the Great Financial Crisis that I discovered the Austrian school, and the things that they were talking about were really the way in which I had been living my life for so many years, like living my life and in attempting to anyways in an intellectually honest, don't kid yourself manner and do no harm manner. And there was this whole economic school of thought related to this, I never even knew existed. And so I was gobbling up that like crazy for a long, and still am. And then, and I read the other schools too, like particularly classical economists like the Brits and the French, Jean-Baptiste Say and Frederick Bastiat, fantastic. And then to like podcasts that I listen to, like I'm a big fan of Bob Murphy. I mentioned him in my book, and he's got the Human Action podcast, which I listen to regularly. George Selgin, I follow. He's not an Austrian school economist. I think he might have been at one time. Now he's more like a free banking type economist. He believes in, maybe he's a market monetarist, I'm not sure, but nominal GDP targeting is what he's a big fan of. And the Austrians wouldn't like that because it's still too much, you know, interference. Now, Selgin might say, well, the interference from central banks caused this calamity. Now we have to instill more interference to fix it. I'm not an expert in that, but George Selgin, I really like, I learned a lot from him. And Stephen Cates, he's an Australian, well, he's actually Canadian, but he lives in Australia. He's got an amazing book on Say's Law. So S-A-Y apostrophe S, that was Jean-Baptiste Say. And I highly recommend reading that or anything that Stephen Cates puts out. I think he's a very, very good writer, very honest writer. Again, doesn't have an ulterior motive. You know, he's just trying to help educate people with respect to how an economy really works. So those are the three main people that I mentioned in my book in the acknowledgement section.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Before I just realized that I wanted to ask you this, and maybe you know a little bit about it, maybe not. It's up to you to respond. But what do you think about this jump nowadays to stable coins and the, you know, CBDCs as they call them? For me, and this is just from as ignorant as I am, just following whatever is happening and reading about it, it seems to me that it's just another way of kicking the debt down the road by basically introducing more people into the system by allowing, you know, people from other countries to actively be a part of the dollar or whatever other CBDC yep. there will be system. Is that what you would also consider?
Yeah, so in terms of stable coins, you know, with the Genius Act, they required like full 100% reserves, right, on these stable coins. And so U.S. Treasuries, I mean, I think the shorter term U.S. Treasuries, but still, they help to create new demand for U.S. debt. And these coins are only stable with respect to, the U.S. dollar. yeah, exactly. The unstable dollar. So if the U.S. dollar gets devalued 90%, guess what? So is your stable coin. Now, if it was backed by gold or something, completely different issue. And I think, you know, there are a lot of benefits to having digital currencies, easier to transact and all this kind of stuff, but they are also subject to abuse. So it's just like fiat currency. If you had strict rules in place, then they might not be bad, but definitely don't want a central bank digital currency because I don't trust them.
Yeah, no, wonderful. Yeah, you sort of confirmed my exploration there. So maybe we'll catch up another time about this as the situation unfolds. Now, I usually invite my guests to share with the listeners as we finish whatever is on your heart, maybe something we've not covered that you'd like to still cover. Maybe it's completely something else. Sometimes it's a quote, sometimes it's an idea, an observation, an invitation for people. It does not have to be related to what we've discussed. whatever, you know, rings in your heart.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it is related to what we were talking about. And I would just say to your listeners, don't give up. It's not hopeless. It might seem hopeless, and Lynn Alden might be right that nothing stops this train. But I think it is going to stop. And maybe naively, I don't know, I've got great faith in people. You know, great faith, not just in people's intelligence. I think the average person is very smart. But also in their goodness. Most people are good people. They like to see other people succeed. They like to help other people. There are exceptions, of course. Some high-profile ones, maybe. But we can't let that stop us. And I think if enough, I believe, again, maybe naively, that the only thing stopping us from fixing this system is that people don't really understand what's going on. And if enough people do, then those in charge will not be able to stop it from changing. I truly believe that. And so all the stuff that you're talking about, you're helping. There's many others as well who are trying to get the world on side here. And it's not going to be easy. And it's not going to be a smooth path, that's for sure. But if people actually come to believe all of this, and they believe that the necessary but painful things that are required to fix it ensure that we're all in this together, and you can actually trust our leaders, trust our policymakers, then I think it'll all happen. Like, it will be unstoppable. But it's not going to be easy to get to that place. But I think we will.
Amen. Yeah, no, if anything, it I probably agree with you to the degree that it might just have to take a generation. You know, maybe my generation are the ones who are starting to see the cracks and learning about them. And then as we bring forth our children, God willing, maybe they will be educated enough and demanding enough to make that change as we grow old. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time today. It's been a pleasure, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you much. Thanks for having me.
It was awesome. Thank you so much, everyone who's listening, and we might be seeing Paul again. Other than that, have a wonderful rest of your day.